Number four, HPA rules. This is a briefing.
You're back with us.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Commissioners, Director. Well, I think I'm missing the Director, Deputy Director. So this morning I am here to talk about four new sections that are proposed for the hydraulic code rule update. But before I do that, I'd like to just give a little overview of some highlights from November that we did in preparation for the rule update. First of all, the draft programmatic environmental impact statement is still out for public review, and the comment period will end next Friday. So as part of that process, it was really important to us that we get out and meet with as many key stakeholders and tribes as we could. So this last month, we've had two meetings with tribes. We've met with cities and counties, environmental groups, Marine Trades Association, just to try to get out and talk to people about what the rule update is about and what's intended to do. The other thing is we're working with our public affairs office to update our website. And we're doing this for two reasons. One is to really highlight the importance of the hydraulic code in light of the rule update. And the other, and also to show all the improvements that we've made in the last couple years to the hydraulic project approval program. The other reason for the website redesign is to help applicants. We want to get better information up on our website to help applicants complete their application right the first time. So we're proposing a redesign to help them do that. And then we also hired an economist to start preparing the economic analysis for the rule update for the CR-102. So the four chapters, four sections I'm going to discuss today are common construction requirements, artificial aquatic habitat structures, forage fish spawning beach surveys, and marine vegetation surveys. So common construction practices are requirements that apply to many types of hydraulic project approvals. These are really the best management practices that contractors use on site to protect the environment. Currently, we have common construction requirements in our rules, but we have the same requirement repeated in several places depending on the project type. So what we've done is we've consolidated those requirements and brought them into a single section. So all of these best management practices are together, and they're only listed once in the rules. So therefore, things like protecting riparian areas by restricting the work access corridor for equipment, or making sure that concrete is cured before the in-water area is rewatered, or the sediment and erosion control to make sure that dirty water doesn't get into the stream. It also includes work area isolation, which I don't know if you can see the picture very well. This is actually an example of work area isolation where they've constructed a cofferdam around a bridge that's being demoed, and they do this to isolate the work area from the flowing river. It also allows them to then remove the fish that are in that area and then release them safely. So that's another example of one of the common construction requirements. Now there's a couple of concerns that we've heard regarding our requirements. And one is that the water quality provisions are too vague. And the other is the concern that we're not proposing to allow tires for use in the aquatic environment. The water quality issue is a little bit complicated, so I'm going to try to explain. The legislature's made it pretty clear in their stormwater amendment to our statute that we have hydraulic code authority for protection of fish life, and ecology has the Clean Water Act authority for protecting water resources. So really respectful of that. So in our rules, we do put in water quality provisions, but they're very general. They're very performance based. They tell the applicant to install erosion and sediment protection to prevent sediment and from entering the water. But we don't go to the extent that ecology does in their permits us of telling an applicant how you would do that, what kind of method you would need to do. So with that, you're probably asking why would we even put water quality provisions in our rules. The reason is that the Clean Water Act is triggered by a federal permit, the review is. There are a lot of hydraulic projects that don't require federal permits. So if there isn't any clean water provisions in our rules, in those cases, there wouldn't be any rules to follow. So I hope I made that clear. But okay. The other is the tire issue. This picture actually shows a tire revetment on the Duwamish. There are some studies that show that that tires can leach chemicals into the water. Most of the studies have been based on particulate studies, so they're looking at stormwater runoff from roadways into water bodies and showing that there's an increase in zinc, which is can be toxic. So so we propose to not allow the use of tires in the aquatic environment. Now, we actually had somebody come out from the Rubber Manufacturers Association from back east to talk to us about a regulation. Because in the original regulation in version 3 of the rules, we actually said tires and tire byproducts. And when we thought of tire byproducts, we were actually thinking of things that were made out of cut-up tires. Okay. And they came out and talked to us and pointed out the fact that a lot of products that are authorized for use in the aquatic environment are made out of recycled tires. So they were concerned about the language. And so we changed that language. But we still have the restriction on tires. And they would like to see maybe some application of the use of tires in the aquatic environment. So they're going to provide some science to us, which I told them we would definitely review. The other comment on this issue came from dock builders in Eastern Washington. They use tires. They fill tires with concrete and use them as anchors to anchor, especially dock systems or mooring buoys. So they would like to be able to continue to use tires in that capacity. So. Again, these are draft rules. We're going to take a look at all the information we get and balance that information with the mandate to protect fish life and see what we can do. But some of these issues, they're not real clear cut. There's science, and you're always balancing the information with the need to protect fish life. But it is a balancing. So I like Dave Price's statement of it's not rocket science, it's biology, it's harder. So the second section today is aquatic habitats, artificial aquatic habitat structures. And these are our structures that are placed to aid fish and shellfish management goals. So currently we don't have any regulations in WAC for these structures, and there's been more interest in recent years, especially from the dive community, about having these structures. They're also been identified as being important structures for rockfish recovery. So we worked really close with the fish program when we developed these rules to ensure that the rules met the rockfish recovery goals as well as the other policies in the fish program. So we wanted to make sure that they were compatible. So Olympia oysters and Dungeness crab, a lot of times shell is placed in the intertidal or shallow subtidal, shell reefs to enhance the recolonization of Olympia oysters or the settlement of juvenile Dungeness crab. So that's another use for these aquatic habitat structures. A lot of people just think of artificial reefs, but there are other structures as well. So one point I did want to make that is if these structures are constructed for commercial aquaculture, they are exempt from the hydraulic code rules. So this would just cover in the case of Olympia oysters, for example, the reintroduction or restoration of Olympia oysters that aren't associated with commercial aquaculture. So aquatic habitat structures, the benefits must outweigh the negative impacts is one of the requirements. And so they must meet one of the following needs: the enhancement of fish viewing opportunities, enhancement of conservation of aquatic resources such as rockfish, or mitigation for impacted fish habitat, and that would be compensatory mitigation. There's also a requirement in the rules for pre and post project surveys, and some instructions for siting artificial reefs. So the third section today is intertidal forage fish spawning habitat surveys. The department has been doing forage fish spawning surveys for about 30 years. And to date, the department's documented about 259 linear miles of surf smelt spawning beach and about 117 linear miles of sand lance spawning beach. These fish are really important prey species, especially for salmon. 35% of juvenile salmon diets are sand lance, and for juvenile chinook, it's actually 60%. So these fish, again, spawn on the beach. This is actually a picture of a surf smelt here. Looks like a very pregnant surf smelt. And the map below shows, and the highlighted areas actually show the documented surf smelt spawning areas. So we condition HPAs to protect these habitats. They are habitats of special concern in saltwater areas. And usually we restrict timing to work, so projects work around the time when these fish are spawning on the beaches, if the work's going to be done on the beach. But we have cases where the surf smelt spawn sometimes year-round. So in those cases, we require a survey as part of the permit. So the applicant goes out, has to go out within 72 hours of starting work. We can do the survey for them if we're available, or they can hire a private consultant that the department's trained to do the survey. Now, one of the concerns that we've had an environmental group, and I don't know if you're aware of this, that's appealed several of our HPAs in the last couple of months. Based on primarily because we don't apply restrictions on potential forage fish spawning habitat. Okay, so it's been it's our opinion that if we're going to restrict when you can do the work, how you're going to do the work, that we need to know that the habitat is there, and we need to know that the project is likely to cause harm to that habitat. So in cases where it's potential and we don't have the documentation to show that it is actually used for spawning, then we have not applied these conditions. So so I just wanted you to be aware of that. Okay, so seagrass and macroalgae surveys. These are surveys that we actually require as part of an application if an applicant is going to do dredging or trenching or construct a dock in usually shallow subtidal areas. And we use this information to help them locate their project in a location to minimize to avoid or minimize the shellfish or to minimize the eelgrass and macroalgae habitat. Seagrass and macroalgae are really important habitats for salmon, for Dungeness crab, and other commercially important species. In addition, they're just important to the ecosystem in general, for the marine ecosystem. Hundreds of species use this vegetation habitat. So again, hydraulic projects must mitigate for impacts to seagrass and kelp and other macroalgae. This is also a saltwater habitat of special concern. And by mitigate, we mean avoid and minimize where we can, and where you can't, then you have to compensate for the loss of it. So the surveys help us do that. And most of the time, a lot of times, the biologists can do the surveys at low tides. But where we can't see what's there, and it's and the work's being done between really extreme low tide and say minus 20 or 25, then we have to ask for these surveys, and they're done by divers. So that's the four chapters I have today. There's some other kind of major concerns that have come up that I just want to make you aware of. The one is the concern about increased cost from our culvert and bridge construction provisions. And as I said, we did hire an economist who will be looking at this issue to see if there is an increased cost. So we are hearing that. We're hearing it from the cities and counties and WashDOT and from the forest industry that they're concerned about the cost. The other concern that came up was our freshwater docks, which actually I'll be presenting on next month. We have width restrictions. In lakes where we have anadromous salmonids. So juvenile salmon school along in shallow water in these lakes. Research has shown when they come to structures like piers that have a very hard shadow line where you have a big light to dark contrast, that they will actually not go under the pier structure. They will turn and they will go around it. And there's concern that this could actually subject them to more predation. The other thing is in freshwater, overwater structures where we have areas with warm water species, you know, they're bass like these. And bass are also a predator fish for salmonids. So we proposed in our rules to have a 4-foot wide width restriction on piers for the first 30 feet and then 6 feet thereafter in these water bodies where we have anadromous salmon. I got a phone call from a jurisdiction on Lake Washington that said this was going to be a major concern for their constituents, this width restriction. So we are looking at the science. We've got a lot of research that's been done on overwater structures to see where we can give more flexibility in the rules. And we can consider things like the height of the pier, the orientation of the pier, the amount of grading that's being put in. So I think we will be able to give more flexibility, but it's one of the changes that we're going to be making. But I did want to make you aware of this just in case it did come back to you. The last major concern I want to talk about today is the concern about our streamlined permit process. And in my first presentation to you, I talked about all the different types of permits that we issue. And two of our standard permits are general HPAs and simplified HPAs. And just to kind of refresh your memory, general HPAs are HPAs that we issue typically to other governments, agencies, cities and counties in WSDOT for transportation maintenance work, and ecology for installing stream gauges and other scientific instruments, DNR for derelict vessel removal. These are, in our mind, are fairly low-risk project types. And so we issue a general that covers this work, and it could cover all the work done in a county or statewide. We don't look at these projects on an individual-by-individual basis, and that is a concern for the environmental groups and the tribes. They would feel more comfortable if we were looking at each hydraulic project separately, but we don't have the staff capacity to do that. So we've tried to explain that we're trying to take some low-risk work off of our plate so we can concentrate on the high-risk work and spend more time on that, where we think we do get better, more fish protection. But you're likely to hear from the environmental group and the groups and the tribes that this is a concern. Simplified HPA is a little less so because they are individual HPAs for 8 project types that are low risk, and they do go through the normal permitting process. It's just a simpler form. So there's really just a couple of changes they wanted to the tribes in particular asked to make to the form in order for them to feel more comfortable. So we'll likely be doing that. So next meeting, Commissioner Mankin asked for a briefing on mineral prospecting. So Pat Chapman will be joining me to talk about mineral prospecting. And then I'll also be covering a little bit more about freshwater docks, boat ramps and launches, and shipping terminals next month. So thank you very much.
I have 3 questions. One is, have we ever considered the removal of some artificial tire breakwaters and artificial reefs in Puget Sound? I know the dive community has looked at these. They're very, very poor in terms of their ability to support fish and fish recovery as compared to, say, a quarry rock type artificial reefs. Mm-hmm. That's my first question.
Okay.
My second question is, how do you...
Can you give her one at a time
okay.
so she can remember?
Okay.
Be kind.
So certainly if somebody came in with an application to remove a tire reef, there wouldn't be any problem with us issuing an HPA for that work. We respond to requests for permits, so we're... we would certainly, I think, as a department, probably... I can't speak for the department, but I know that we would issue an HPA for the removal of a tire reef. We agree that they're not very stable, and in fact, the rules you'll see in the rules for the aquatic artificial aquatic habitat structures that it is limited to rock and other
Good, thank you. Second question, how do you mitigate for loss of eelgrass habitat?
So really the only way you can do that is by transplanting it. So typically where we've had projects that impacted large areas of eelgrass, they've actually harvested that eelgrass before the project took place. They've stored that in circular tanks up at Battelle Labs, the WSDOT project for a ferry terminal, and then they replanted it in a different location near the ferry terminal after it was constructed. So really, if you're going to do in-kind mitigation, the transplanting and monitoring is a very expensive proposition, and it's high risk. We have a higher degree of failure with that. So that's where the avoidance and minimization and the dive surveys really help us if we can get there. Because we can oftentimes have people just move their dock a little so that they avoid it.
Good, thank you. And my third and final question
is the impact of overwater structures on salmonid behavior and predation. Is that backed by good science?
There is science to back it up. There's been some studies, one in Lake Washington in particular that's local. It's what makes it difficult is the behavior isn't observed all the time, right? So sometimes they go out and around it. Sometimes they'll go under it. We think there's an increase in risk when they do change their behavior. So again, it's biology, right? So it is difficult sometimes to know what the right balance is in terms of risk management for the fish and the work.
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, other questions? Okay, I have one for you. Do we distinguish between native and non-native eelgrass for the mitigation requirement?
Yeah.
And why would we want to mitigate for non-native eelgrass?
Right. So the current rules, we have Zostria marina, yeah, and not japonica. So we are proposing not to provide the same protection to Zostria, japonica, as we do marina. So
throughout its range, so we're including Puget Sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's still some concerns about, well, that we don't know enough about the ecological benefit of japonica. Mm-hmm. But when you're coming from the practical side of things, can't very well ask an applicant to mitigate for a species that you're allowed to eradicate as an invasive species. So we are removing that from the rule.
Good.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
Personally. Okay. Any other questions? Great job. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Very important topic. We appreciate it.